This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Every day at the top of this program, I announce that we are a production of Illinois Public Media. It's one of many, many products of public media in our country, from news shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered, to television series like Nova and Frontline. And of course, in this modern era, podcasts. Lots and lots of podcasts. All this is maybe not what Dean Kosten had in mind when he spoke before a Senate committee hearing on what became the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. He was Deputy Undersecretary of what was then the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and he actually helped write the act. This is part of what he had to say.
Well, I would be very disappointed if educational television did not offer a considerable diversity of programs for a diversity of tastes. And the one of the major objections to commercial television today is that it's something of a straitjacket, and perhaps necessarily so, in the nature of the medium. In the case of publishing, you can walk into a bookstore and have a choice of 10,000 books, but there are only three prime evening hours and so many channels, and you're limited.
Now, of course, we are not so limited, 500 channels and nothing on, but it took decades of work in the early to mid-20th century to lay the foundation for all that we have now in public media. And there were a lot of chances for things to go wrong along the way. Parts of that road ran right through Illinois, the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And there's a new book that looks at all of that history and how public media overcame humble beginnings to get where it is today. The book is called Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. It's out now from the University of Illinois Press. The book's author is Josh Shepard. He's an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's also director of the Sound Submissions Project at the Library of Congress, and he joins us now. Professor Shepard, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to begin our conversation the same way you begin the book, with the experiences of early public media through the lens of a man named Charles Sipeman, if I'm saying that correctly. He was sent by the British Broadcasting Corporation to evaluate what was then called university broadcasting, and he painted a rather dire picture in his report. What did he see, particularly at the University of Illinois?
Yeah, thank you. So Charles Sipeman was sent by the BBC as director of talks to evaluate the American equivalent or parallel of non-commercial media in the 1930s, in 1936. And around that time, American educational radio had experienced a series of regulatory and institutional defeats and failures for a good 15 years or so, based upon its lack of infrastructure for being able to understand like the logistics of radio, how to manage transmitters, how to talk with an audience, and really how to extend curriculum from the classroom to the new technology. And so he was brought in by a Rockefeller Foundation grant after the recommendation of a young Edward R. Murrow, who was brought to the BBC also on a Rockefeller Foundation grant to study with the methodologies of the BBC. So Sipeman arrives in New York in 1936, and they send him all around the country to all of the land-grant universities, so the Big Ten universities, Midwest on the most part. And he goes from station to station, and what he finds is maybe two or three people broadcasting at strange times per day, you know, maybe a educational home economics show. One week is on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. The following week, it's on Thursdays at 1 p.m. No one is told. No one can actually go through the distance learning curriculum in the way that it was shaped at that moment. And he writes these scathing reviews for the Rockefeller Foundation, who's considered the main funder of the 1930s of non-commercial media. And they're considering extending that to educational broadcasting. And he's so alarmed by what he sees, especially in Illinois and especially in places like Ohio State, which become later flagship stations for non-commercial media, that he writes this document that essentially removes funding for non-commercial media in the US. And he's quite cutting about it. He talks about people's sort of way, you know, the way that they hold themselves and talk and comport themselves as being non-professional and too provincial. He talks about the ways in which the stations themselves are run inefficiently. And he also talks a lot about the ways that the infrastructure or the lack thereof for non-commercial media in the US just needs tremendous amounts of technical work for it to resemble something like the BBC.
So many wheels turning in my head about that, including imagining what a sort of provincial American broadcaster would have sounded like compared to what was considered proper at the BBC in the mid-1930s. Now a message from the king, something like that. But let's stick with the University of Illinois. Our boss, Moss Bresnahan, the director of our home station, is fond of pointing out that we were on the air before the BBC was, but obviously we did not develop as thoroughly as quickly. What were some of the obstacles and problems faced by the early versions of public media in our country?
Yeah, so there's a few ways to look at this question. So Illinois becomes, of course, one of the most important ones, which I'm sure we'll get to here, not too long after the 1936 visit by Seatman. But, you know, the programming was considered strange at a lot of schools. It was extremely provincial by the ears of most listeners. There wasn't a sense of a relationship between expertise in something in particular and then a general listenership and then how to streamline that so that there could be a wider audience. So like one of my favorite examples is University of Oregon, actually, very early, also 1920s, had a show on how to use modern plumbing, which I thought people found strange. Another one in the personal letters of the early National Association of Educational Broadcasters, the group that went on to build public media, there was a report from University of South Dakota that they were complaining that no one wanted to listen to the show of drama performed in low German dialect. You know, there was no intended
audience. Shocking.
And so when you get to Illinois, for example, of course, a lot of the virtues of Midwestern broadcasting came from its ability to do weather reports, stock reports for farming, and, you know, drama, you know, like just sort of giving a view into the kind of theatrical performances that would be associated with the BBC at the time. So the big problem was there would be no practicing or, you know, pre-development before a show. People would just go on with scripts. They didn't know how to talk into a mic. That's one of the things that just blows my mind the most about early educational radio, is that they didn't understand just to keep your mouth a certain distance from the mic. All these things we take for granted now, since everyone has a podcast, like that I know pretty much, is we're not discovered yet. You know, it was not a part of the vernacular of using what we would now call like educational technology. And, you know, the real goal at that moment was to extend university services so that the whole state might receive the same kind of access to what classrooms were getting in Chicago or Urbana-Champaign or Bloomington Normal. But of course, it was almost impossible for a farmer to ride the horse, you know, 30, 40 miles in the evening after working all day.
Sure.
For an evening class. So that's where radio really started to pick up momentum, was its ability to reach these rural audiences so that everyone could have the same education.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what you're talking about. People say we don't know how to use microphones. That's crazy. You know, something, speaking of educational radio, because obviously that's where public media sort of finds its groove and eventually blooms into public broadcasting. But at least in the 30s, commercial media argued that they did a better job of educational broadcasting than the university stations. How'd that work out for them?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that they probably did do a better job in terms of just reaching the audiences in ways that the audiences wanted to be reached. There was a very famous classical composer named Walter Damrosch who had a show, and he figured out how to play a classical song and then break it up into parts. So here's the violin, you know, here's the bassoon, and then put it back together. And it really taught a whole generation of educational listeners music appreciation about how things work with classical music. That, of course, took just a huge amount of money and practice and a huge staff and the right technology and the right distances from the mics for a whole orchestra. And so they were able to do that, you know, on commercial media. There was a similar show in Wisconsin called Journeys in Music Land that became a real hit and ran for decades and decades that emulated that model, commercial model. And actually, a lot of the early stations pulled from NBC Chicago. There was a program director named Judith Waller, and she had learned how to reach audiences in a way that they actually wanted to hear education. It wasn't like eating spinach. It was more like Chicago pizza for them.
Well, and the U of I director of broadcasting, Joseph Wright, called attention to this in the 30s, right? To the problem that educational broadcasters refusing to learn better practices, right?
Yeah, so there's this organization called the Association for College and University Broadcasters, which no one needs to remember the name. It eventually changes its name to the National Association of Educational Broadcasters. And it's had a rotating set of presidents, largely from Wisconsin to Illinois to Iowa State, Iowa. And every year or two, they would switch. And Joseph Wright was one of its very early presidents, and it had a very sort of practical mindset about what it means to just do good radio as an extension service of education. And you see these letters going back and forth between the other land-grant universities. And Joseph Wright is persistently saying, you know, we can't make our case to universities to have this funded without advertising, or we can't make a case to audiences why they should listen to us instead of vaudeville, you know, being streamed in from New York or would have gone on landlines back then. Unless we actually give them a reason to listen, they have to want to listen. They have to want to be interpolated into the model of education that they're being given through technology. And he also was very astute about what was going on with policy at the time. And so there's this a series of policies between 1927 and 34 that lead to a sort of overemphasis on commercial media that they just fundamentally resist, because they believe in this equal access to education through technology model. And so their influences are very different than the commercial sphere. And he's great at articulating that. You know, so for educators, they were using radio because it was an extension of compulsory education. And so those philosophies were influenced by like a John Dewey or something like that. Whereas commercial media, you know, emerged out of manufacturing wings in New Jersey and New York. And so they were selling receivers and entertainment so that you would buy the receivers. So the philosophy of educational media becomes articulated around the time, and especially at Illinois, and especially at Wright, especially in the early 30s.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm going to do a little professional broadcasting here. We are speaking with Josh Shepard, who is the author of Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting, which is out now from the U of I Press. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. Maybe you have a long memory and you've heard, you lived through some of this early public broadcasting, even into the 40s, 50s, and 60s, before we really had NPR and PBS in this country, which we are going to get to that formation as we continue our conversation. 800-222-9455. So one of the more influential events in early public broadcasting history, you mentioned some of these organizations, but it happened at the University of Illinois. We talked about those struggles that U of I's station and other stations went through, as described by Charles Siebman. So how does the University of Illinois end up taking center stage?
Yeah, a couple things happen. So in 1934, the first major media policy in the United States is called the Communications Act. And it's kind of a long story that's detailed in the book. But the short of it is that the country lines up with commercial media's ownership of the technical infrastructure as the most convenient form for growing media in the country. And so part of that was the nascent form of educational media could not meet the criteria of the act. And so that's the short of it. And so by 1935, almost all the stations in the country that were not up to par lost their licenses. So there's this big experiment from about 1921 to 1934. And then suddenly 70% of the stations are gone, like overnight in 1935. And so it really went back to the Midwestern universities to say, okay, we have these strong principles. And we have this concept that everyone should receive equal access to education. Technology is going to do this for us. And so how can we actually meet criteria of the regulation and then regrow? And so they actually do that over time. And a whole bunch of things kind of happen in between. They begin to develop modes of research to see if it's working. That becomes the foundation of communication departments in the United States. The research they begin to innovate at that time resembles public policy research now, and it gauges audience demographics and how they understand what they're hearing. They also just simply improve the stations, and they have broadcast schedules, and they teach people, they have practicums in the summer, and people go to Ohio State especially to learn how to talk on the radio and how to perform live, you know, on the radio. And so over time, these different steps lead to a moment in the post-war era where the National Association of Educational Broadcasters, who I mentioned before, all come back from the war. Everyone's in the war and they come back. They've worked in the OWI, they've worked with the military, they've done educational services, and they have a better sense of how to do this. And in 1949, they go back to the Rockefeller Foundation and they say, well, you fund to see if we can try this again. And of course, they bring back Seatman, who's pretty enthusiastic still for the possibility of it, but wants it to be good. They bring back the researchers from the 1930s who developed what they called media effects research. And they have these conferences. So there's two conferences, and everyone from the 1930s reconvenes. And they begin
Let's pause there. We need to take a break. So that's maybe a good tease. We will talk about those conferences, at least one of which happens in Central Illinois. I think if we're talking about the same thing here. We will continue our conversation with Josh Shepard when we return. His book is Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. More to come after a short break. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Josh Shepard, who's an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, also director of the Sound Submissions Project at the Library of Congress. And more to the point for our conversation, he's out with a new book from the University of Illinois Press. It's called Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting, about how a disorganized group of educational radio stations in America, through a lot of cajoling and effort over the years among themselves, among legislators, eventually became the public broadcasting system, PBS and NPR, that we have today. So before the break, we were talking about it's the post-war era. People are coming back. They want to sort of make another go at organizing educational public media. And they have a couple of conferences. And you were, please pick up where we left off.
Yes, thank you very much. So, you know, the crucial point for them in 1949 was that they hadn't had a reason that they should have special frequencies set aside in the early policies. And by 49, they have the data. They're producing data to show that they can actually educate through radio. So they have at the University of Illinois, they have these two conferences over 2 years called the Allerton House Seminars. And it brings everyone who's ever been involved with educational radio back in the shadow of television. Television's about to be implemented through policy in about 1952. And they decide, what if we were to take every discovery and every experiment and unify it into a kind of best practices approach, and then take the best shows produced from each station and just start circulating them, or as they said, peddle them around the country. So if there wasn't a great show in South Dakota, maybe University of Illinois could fill in a gap, you know, for a couple hours per day. And they call that the Bicycle Network. So this big dividend of the Allerton House seminars was that they began to unify as a decentralized network, like the commercial networks, with similar programming.
Well, and that gets at one of the confusions. When I sometimes we encounter people when we're just talking about our work here in public media who don't really draw a distinction between, say, I work for Illinois Public Media based in Urbana. It's different from NPR. Whereas I guess if you look at the BBC, it's much more of a unified top-down system. So talk more about how the American system evolved into this sort of decentralized, two-headed, multi-headed, however you want to phrase it.
Yeah, I think one of the mysteries of American non-commercial media is how people decided that they were going to devote their lives to something that had no money and few listeners, right? So, and that was the 20s through really the 60s. So how do you build an entire media system without any income at all? You know, and this gives rise to the philanthropic approaches, which start with Rockefeller. And this gives rise to universities funding it, which is why most public stations are at universities to this day. And so, you know, the American public media system is really one in which there's a principle that underlies a purpose to equal access to education, to democratic media, to reaching every sized audience. And there's this historical trajectory by which there's experiments with logistics by which they could actually make it work. And it takes like 40 something years, which is really the tenor of the book.
So, okay, with all this in mind, let's go a little bigger picture here, because the book is called Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. Maybe we can break those apart and just talk about the larger context here. Shadow of the New Deal.
So the shadow. So, you know, in before Roosevelt, there was a lot of what we would now call a libertarian policy around media that led towards privatization. And then, you know, that led to a defeat of early educational radio. And then as the New Deal sort of moves in motion, and there's this sense that institutions can serve a public good, and that there can be an agency that's like of the government, but is not directly from the government. You know, that all of that ideology, and I say that word in a positive sense, begins to emerge in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. And then in the shadow of that, you see all of the infrastructure building out of that moment of the 1934 to 1948 moment. And that is where public media came from.
And it's a victory, the victory of public broadcasting. But it wasn't a foregone conclusion, right? Say more about that.
Yeah, so after all the stations lost their licenses in 1934, you know, the question of like, how do you maintain this vision that has a purpose? Like, this is purposive media. It's not just entertainment media. So how do we keep doing that? Keep it nonprofit. And then how do we like, you know, make it work so that people want to listen, so the universities will support it? And, you know, they did it. It took another 34 to 33 years until the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. And they did it largely through logistical practices. And that's sort of one of the answers of the history is, well, the philosophy itself was not enough to persuade policymakers or listeners. Okay, we're nonprofit. But the fact that it could be an extension service of education and then be funded through facilities maintenance grants, which is kind of how the CPB is organized, really then activated the possibility that for advocacy for equal access to education. So sometimes one of the conclusions of the book is sometimes the better activisms that we have hedge their philosophies in terms of the practicalities and logistics at hand in order to persuade those who are not directly invested. So one of the victories of public broadcasting is its way that it was able to be reflexive about how it was able to maintain its vision while learning to play the system and play the games and play the policies until there was a federal agency that was constituted.
And how do we get to that federal agency? How do we get from laying this foundation, right, the educational, the Allerton seminars, the Pedal Network, all the rest, to the point where we actually have these formalized systems that, I mean, today they can be markers of identity, right? In some ways, a lot of people feel I'm a public radio listener. That's something they would say to describe themselves.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear by the late 1950s that the BBC model for what they would have at the time called cultural uplift programming that, you know, ends up like masterpiece theater or something, so that people feel bettered by watching certain kinds of culture. That's kind of a problematic discussion in itself, because whose culture, I think, is a question that should be asked.
Fair point.
But then also the news. I think just the local news, and really I think the magic of public media is in its affiliates a lot of the time, because it reaches audiences in parts of the country where there otherwise might not be news coverage. And it does this through this block system, block grant system that comes from the government, but then is used as it's seen fit by, you know, Panhandle Nebraska, which I live not too far away from in Denver, or other parts of the country. And so the local journalism, I think, is really the way that the principles are seen through to this day.
You know, there's a quote in the book from Richard Hull, who is a president of the National Association of Educational Broadcasters, and he said if educational stations lost their frequencies, listeners would miss out on news, weather, and other information for their area. And he said a station obviously hundreds of miles away wouldn't be able to do that. I think there are parallels to what we're seeing happening in commercial media today, right? Newspapers are folding or, you know, having staffs that are just a fraction of their former strength. You know, it's in some places you'll have a paper with all national headlines, just wire copy on the front page in some of our local communities. Talk about what role you see public media today filling in communities that relates back to what we've been talking about.
Yeah, public media is a democratic experiment, fundamentally, and every possible audience is imagined within its structure, as noted in Bill Simmering's famous mission statement that's written at the founding of NPR in 1970. One of the interesting things about early radio is that a lot of early stations were actually owned by the newspapers, and then as the newspapers have sort of deaccessioned from local reporting when they're owned by national conglomerates, public media has been pretty steadfast in its coverage. So I think that, you know, NPR in particular plays a very special role in localism. So in other words, just keeping the local as present as part of the national discussion. And I think especially in rural areas and in places where a lot of immigrant culture flourishes, that the way that NPR features different experiences, the way it asks people what they think about different political and cultural questions, remains not only viable, but has become a necessity. So the format itself of public media has become a necessity with the decline of commercial investment in local news.
Public media, and we have about 5 minutes left in our conversation. Maybe I should just remind listeners we're speaking with Josh Shepard about his book, Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. You know, public media still faces threats with some regularity, sometimes from within. NPR nearly went under in the early 1980s, but also from outside forces. Near the end of the book, you talk about the many politicians who've wanted to defund public media over the years. Looking at the past and the present, what do we lose as communities, as a society, if we lose public media?
So I do. I believe in public media personally. Let me to write a book about it. I think, you know, the way that public media, before it was public media, really made its case over decades was that it was so tied to the educational infrastructure and all of the different funding that you see it get awarded as it makes progress to increase, you know, its listenership and its infrastructure are tied to educational policies. And the Public Broadcasting Act does something interesting in that it makes it self-sustaining. And, you know, throughout the history of public media, there are, of course, many connections to education still. But in a way, that's like the most inexhaustible possible audience for public media is every year there's going to be new listeners of every possible type and of every possible learning style. And I think that the way that public media has these educational roots and that it could continue to appeal to those roots makes it improbable that it will be you know, removed for political reasons or defunded in different ways. And especially since a lot of red state, as they say, areas are served by the journalism of NPR, I see radio is especially durable with its relationship to the digital now. But I think, like, even bigger than that, the non-commercial media is a representation of the experiment of what it means to try to have every voice participate in American society and to have the same presence within American society. So it's not always successful, but it is the experiment that we need.
Well, just about a minute left in our conversation, but to bring this full circle, early on we talked about distance learning, radio as a medium to spread knowledge of education, right? That's some of the roots of public media. And you talk about how public media could save itself, strengthen itself, further its missions by reconnecting with the public education system. Briefly, what do you see there? What do you hope that would accomplish?
Yeah, so I'm going to defer to my colleagues in public media and education for how that would work. But I think that, you know, the reason there was so much enthusiasm about it was that just basic principle of access, education, and diversity as the concept for the entire media system. And that's what it grew out of. People dedicated their whole lives to that, decades and decades of their lives. So I think in if we're really worried about funding in public media, there's just a huge number of possible grants, there's a huge number of possible listeners, and a huge number of possible interests that would probably look at public media producing educational programming as a net positive for sustaining the agency.
Josh Shepard is the author of Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting, out now from the University of Illinois Press. Josh, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you very much.
And that's all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow on the show, it's been 3 years since the summer of racial reckoning in America following the murder of George Floyd by a police officer in Minnesota, as well as a number of other cases that made national news. There were protests throughout that summer. We talked to a number of guests at the time. We're going to revisit with some of them on our show tomorrow about where things have gone, where we've come, where we have yet to go, looking back on the summer of 2020, tomorrow on the 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield, Kennedy Vincent, and Jose Zepeda. Our intern is Nick Boyven. Technical direction and engineering for our program comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. I want to suggest you find us on your favorite podcast app or on Apple or Spotify or anywhere else you get your podcasts. Just search for The 21st Show. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media since 1922. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.